大家好，欢迎收听花间有剑客 Roses and Swords， 我是主播爱雨。
我是文。
我是洛君。我们是三个从事科研工作的女性，不定时聚在一起聊聊披荆斩棘闯荡学术江湖的日常。
我们在聊天中也梳理自己与世界的关系，科普生态环保问题，讨论女性视角中的社会议题。
Hello， 大家好，欢迎来到花间电台。今天这一期的节目比较特别，这是我们第一次录播全英文的访谈，嘉宾是我的朋友兼同事 Dr. Elaine Bevenest。 我们聚在一起畅聊移民浪潮与全球气候变化的关系，从环境科学聊到社会文化，聊到伦理哲学，希望你能喜欢。如果大家有兴趣听我们三位主播之后再用中文来总结和发散，欢迎大家在留言区告诉我们。那我们现在就开始吧。
It is my great pleasure today to have Dr. Elaine Bevenest onto the podcast today.
Hello, everyone. Very happy to be here. Thank you, Wenying, for the invitation. I'm really grateful.
Yeah, I am super excited to chat with you. And, you know, Elaine and I, we go way back when we were in grad school, and now we both moved to Boston and we're both at Harvard. It just seems like an amazing opportunity to sit down again and catch up and also, you know, vibe about science also.
Absolutely. You know?
So I'm really curious, as a start, how you got into thinking about migrations and climate change.
Yeah, I'm really happy to talk about that. So basically, the way I got to it,I came to it really from the climate side. I've been obsessing over climate change for the better part of like the last decade and a half or something. It's been a while since I knew I wanted to work on climate change. The migration stuff came a little bit later. Basically what happened, so I'm from France, and I've, in the like mid 2010s, like around 2015, around those years, what happened in Europe was that there was the, in particular, the Syrian like migrant crisis. Crisis, quote unquote. And so basically, overall, I think what was happening was that the thinking was that climate change was not really going to physically happen that much in Europe, that Europe was kind of in a geographic location that would be somewhat preserved from like a lot of crazy impacts that you see in the US, such as like hurricanes or like wildfires or flooding, like all of that. There's no hurricanes in Europe. Like all of those physical impacts seem to be very distant from Europe. Although that's not true anymore since last summer and the huge floods that there has been in Germany. I think that the thinking, like the feelings, have changed on that. But the kind of narrative was that climate change was not really something that you could see physically that much in Europe for a while. And so the way I think some people, probably very well-intentioned, tried to raise awareness on climate change was to talk about migration, saying what climate change is going to look like in Europe, it's going to be through huge swath of international migration into Europe.
Interesting.
And that was, I think, partly a way to raise awareness on climate change. And I think probably what at least some of the organizations that raised this issue that way wanted was to say, so this means we need to do something about climate change. Actually, the only thing that we have seen as a consequence in terms of policy has been more an increase in anti-migrant rhetoric and more of a closing of borders around Europe.
Right.
Which, by the way, has many problematic consequences, but if you look strictly about climate change, it doesn't do anything to solve climate change borders. So there was really, to me, a surprising dissonance about focusing basically exclusively on the perspective of the destination areas when thinking about climate change and migration, where actually, when you think about it, what makes probably more sense from a policy perspective is to focus on the migrant communities and on the origin communities, because that tends to be where most of the impacts from climate change are happening. So even if you care mostly about solving climate change, you still want to focus on those groups as a priority.
That's really interesting. After all these years of doing research and readings and, you know, publishing your own work, I wonder how much your thinking along this line has evolved in terms of how much the climate change is displacing migrants, actually causing any sort of migrant crisis, quote unquote.
Yeah, I mean, you hear a lot about those kinds of hot takes in the media, and it's kind of difficult, like, within the academic literature. I think sometimes I hear students ask me questions about, you know, oh, in your paper, you're being extremely careful about how you talk about climate change and migration. Like, why is that? And I think there is clearly a very clear realization within the, like, climate migration community in academia that those types of conclusions tend to be picked up by the media and like in very like hot takes. So I think people are trying to be very mindful of that. I think one of the very important takeaways here is that the consensus at this point is that climate change is not only expected to increase migration of people who would have liked to not move. Mm. It is also expected to reduce mobility for people who would have liked to move. Mm. Because one of the things that are not enough talked about, I think, is that migration is costly for a lot of people. Those who are able to move are really those who can afford to do so.
Absolutely.
And so because climate change can definitely decrease resources, and we know that it's going to do so, in particular in some of the very vulnerable, already deprived communities, well, as it turns out, we're already seeing and we're expecting to see more and more numbers of people who would like to move but are not able to do so.
Mm, right.
And so I think from a policy perspective, there needs to be really this double focus on both the populations who end up moving but don't really want to, and also the populations who would like to be able to move but cannot afford to anymore.
Right.
And I think from a policy perspective, you need to think about both aspects.
So sometimes, you know, you hear these crazy numbers that there's millions and millions of migrants that are going to cross the borders. And I'm wondering, where do those numbers come from? And do they have any sort of evidence to be backed up at all?
Yeah, so, I mean, in the early years of the climate migration literature, some of those numbers were put out and started to really freak people out in a lot of ways. I think you want to differentiate two things. A lot of the early studies in climate migration focused not so much on the number of people who would actually move, but on the number of people who would be exposed.
Mm.
The thinking being, oh, if you do projections of sea level rise on the coast, for instance, you're going to do that. And then you're going to say, oh, within like these 1 or 2 meters of elevation along the coast live that many millions of people around the globe.
Right.
Those people are all at risk of moving
because
of sea level rise. So we're going to say we're going to end up with that many people. So that those are like really the first ways through which those crazy numbers were reached. But I think where the literature has moved forward in the past few years is that it's not because people are at risk or more exposed or enduring more impacts of climate change that they end up moving. And they definitely don't always end up moving across borders at all. Often they move much more locally. And even they don't necessarily move. If you think about sea level rise, for instance, or not necessarily right away. Like sea level rise is a very gradual process. It's not like from one day to the next or even from 1 year to the next where you live is suddenly entirely underwater. What happens is that you get more and more frequent flooding over decades, and at the end, after a while, the thing is permanently underwater. But there is like those really decades times, time scales, where you just get more and more frequent flooding.
And
what some recent studies have shown is that during that period, it's not clear that people will move out necessarily. Because a lot of those coastal areas are where a lot of economic activity happens in a lot of lower income countries. You still actually see projections where you see many more people coming into those areas because of the economic development on the coast. Even though those places are enduring more and more flooding, people don't necessarily, I mean, it's not clear at this point that people are actually internalizing that as a parameter in their decision of mobility to move or not, or to go wherever they decide to go at the end of the day. So I think really overall the literature has come around and has not, you know, people don't really, you know, push along those crazy numbers anymore. You want to include all kinds of different sciences in the exercise, all kinds of different disciplines. Because you see a lot of disciplines in terms of sociology, ethnology, anthropology, who really bring very important perspectives about that's not because people right. are getting flooded every mm-hmm. other week, but right. they're moving out necessarily.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think sort of linking that back to the context of China, when we start to anticipate more and more people moving out of certain agricultural areas because of increasing drought, you know, over many years, all of those migration is also mediated by a governmental policy, right? And I think in the context of China, it's more interesting because a lot of the governmental level policies in terms of where people can live is something that does have a very strong impact about urbanization, about how many people are abandoning agriculture and going to other regions. And like you said, the back of the envelope calculation is something that shows you a very rough number, but in reality, a lot of other factors come in. And that's where at least majority of our efforts in terms of where policy needs to happen need to focus on, right?
Yeah. And it's not just, you know, I'm not saying that in any, it's not an opinion that I'm stating. I think the reason why those other considerations are important when thinking about policy is that, well, what happens in terms of how do you plan for infrastructure, you know, at the city level?
Right.
If you want to dimension like the water resources for a city or like sewage or like whatever right. infrastructures are needed, you need to think about what the migrations dynamics are going to look like, both, you know, within the city and going out of the city.
Absolutely.
And that's why those considerations about do people actually move or not when they're in distress are important because they matter for planning generally.
And then it comes to the issue of like what sort of things need to be put in place for climate adaptations, right? In all of these regions, without assuming that everybody's just going to move.
Now, moving away from the sort of back of the envelope calculations, I'm curious to know whether over the years we've had a better understanding in terms of how climate change might be causing the different trends of migrations on a global scale.
Again, the context is very, it matters a lot usually, but what tends to be the consensus is that disasters, so kind of extreme events, tend to induce displacement that tends to be pretty local and pretty short term. It's not entirely true,
right.
but that tends to be the norm. Whereas when you see longer onset events, such as droughts, such as slow decreases in agricultural yields or sea level rise, or those types of like longer term events, the migration response is much more diffuse. It tends to be more permanent. By and large, we see the most of the direct effects of environmental change on migration being on within cross-border migration. You can see some ripple effect on cross-border migration down the line, but the bulk of the populations who end up changing their mobility outcome through environmental change seems to be within borders.
You know, we talked about how much climate change affects migration, but how much we think migration might also feed back to climate change. Is there some sort of consensus in academia about that?
Yeah, this notion of feedback loop it tends to be a question that intrigues a lot of the modelers out there. it's an interesting one. What you think about, it's actually part of, you can think about feedbacks in two ways. If you think about feedback of migration on climate change in terms of climate change itself as a physical phenomenon, that would mean looking at the effects of migration on greenhouse gas emissions. We did that, and by and large, what you find, especially focusing on international migration, which is what we've been talking about a lot here, is that it has very little effect on cross-border migrants tend to take, cross-border migration tends to play a huge take a huge space in the media, in the public discourse.
Right.
It's actually not that many people in terms of overall global population. If you look at migration flows, it stays like below, like in the order of magnitude of like 1% it's not that much. And when you look at, when people move from one place to another, they might change their consumption patterns that might affect overall global emissions, but it's really entirely at the margin. And so it doesn't really have, I think that it doesn't really have any effect on climate change as a physical, as a physical phenomenon.
Right.
However, I think the more interesting feedback loop happens on the adaptation side of climate change. And that gets back to the important this aspect that we discussed earlier, which is, one of the very important ways that a lot of lower income countries go through development patterns is through migration communities that leave and go work somewhere else and then send back money in the form of remittances to their home communities. Mm. And in places, so one of the famous examples is a country like Nepal, for instance, where about close to 30%, like the remittances that are sent back to Nepal amount to close to 30% of Nepal's GDP.
Oh, wow.
So it's really, really substantial.
Mm-hmm.
And those types of mechanisms really are important drivers of development for lower-income countries.
Absolutely.
And so what does it mean if you look at that climate change? What it means that international migration might be both a way to get out of harm's way and a way to provide important resources for people who stay in those locations and who might get hit by impacts of climate change, but who would have perhaps more resources to be able to cope with the impacts or to, you know, do adaptation measures in situ. And so I think you really don't want to discount the importance of migration dynamics overall as an important way of providing adaptation capability, both through for the populations who move and the populations who stay.
Absolutely. Especially, you know, for these low-income countries, this is also where you have the inequality that's most drastic, right? And where, you know, as the global community tends to say that you're putting a lot of efforts into develop these nations and develop these regions. And what I'm thinking, if I may add here, and you can tell me if that actually sounds right or wrong, in a way, I feel like this direct remittance back to the community, mostly to people that you already know, right, your family members and whatnot, that provides such a direct support for the local community that gives the power back to the local community. Versus you have international extension agencies that come with certain agendas, sometimes very well intentioned, but sometimes, you know, is an export of power. And I think that just changes the dynamics so much. And in a way, I feel like this is such a win-win solution in that case, in terms of building resilience for these local communities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think you definitely want to see it in that way. It's also important if, you know, if people want to be able to develop economic development where they are and not have to move, it's important that people have the means to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you really don't want to discount the reality on the ground today, which is that international migration and remittance networks are a really powerful way, mechanism of development for a lot of lower income countries, and in particular, a lot of middle to lower income communities within those countries.
Right. From a global perspective, do you see any sort of trends in terms of which region tend to be one type versus the other?
So that's something that is not well understood yet at this point. When you look at all the empirical studies that have been done, depending on which part of the world they look at, and it's not even clear that, oh, Africa is going to turn out this way versus South Asia would turn out that way. We see, depending on the data you look at, really depending on the study, sometimes you see an increase in out-migration and sometimes you see a decrease in out-migration. Mm-hmm. And often what you see is that in middle-income areas or for middle-income communities, a significant climate-related shock would push people out. But in really impoverished communities, you would see more of a decrease in the migration response because people cannot even afford to do that.
Right.
So it's not that the need is not there. It's that the ability to do so is not there.
Right, right. And I could imagine, like, for the regions that are suffering a lot from climate disasters, they probably lose a big portion of their livelihood to start with, and then obviously, you know, that makes it even worse that they don't have any means of escaping that sort of climate disasters, right?
Exactly. And I think it's particularly important not to diminish at all the importance of focusing on the people who end up being displaced. That's very important.
Mm-mm-mm.
But I've been really trying to insist on that other category of people who end up not being able to move at all, because often in the public discourse, those are communities who are entirely overlooked because they don't move, they're not very visible, they're not really talked about, and they end up, as you point out, in situations of dire need.
Right, absolutely. Cross-border migration certainly gets to perhaps more of the other categories where people have the means to go, right?
Yeah.
So
it's definitely more expensive.
Right.
Or not just talking about money. It requires all kinds of resources that people don't necessarily have. It's mm-hmm. often much easier to move abroad if mm-hmm. you already know people there.
Right.
If you already have some kind of a community that could like welcome you on the way there.
Right, right.
So existing migration networks play an important part in migration outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely true that overall greater resources are needed for cross-border migration than for within country migration.
Right. I think this is such an interesting part of the discussion, in the sense, you know, we think a lot about the refugee crisis, right? We think about people who are fleeing certain regions because of conflicts or other type of disasters that they have to leave because they don't really have another alternative. And then you have another group of people who are seeking a better economic life voluntarily because they have the means to do that. How much do you think that is happening in terms of the climate change space that's pushing people crossing the borders, voluntarily doing it for a better life versus basically no other alternatives they have to leave?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is pinpointing down what's voluntary or not is really difficult, you know. It's almost a philosophical question. To what extent are people constrained to do this and that?
Right.
The question is, you're an individual and you end up having to make a choice among different options.
Right.
Some of which might be good, all of which might be terrible, depending on the situation you're in.
Right.
So to what extent is your agency being in, you know, being at play here? It's not quite clear. The question of the voluntary versus like forced to move thing matters a lot for law. It's really about the refugee status that you mentioned.
Yes.
The refugee denomination is a legal status. And this kind of separation between a migration that would be entirely forced versus a migration that is not under the refugee status, would, quote-unquote, be voluntary, it's much grayer. It's not at all as black and white in reality when you look on the ground. If you think about someone who perhaps has had a really bad season with their crops and who decides to move, well, they're going to fall under the category of an economic migrant.
Mm-hmm.
But is it really that different from someone who has their crops destroyed by like a conflict or something else and then ends up moving and then is allowed to get through the refugee status because, you know, the notion of persecution can kind of be traced better. So my point being, this difference between what's voluntary or not is much grayer in reality than what tends to be made by law. And
absolutely.
And those are laws that are often made by the destination countries, really. The lived experience of people on the ground, again, is a mix of all kinds of different things. And I think climate change really adds a layer to all this gray area. Because on the one hand, it can decrease agency in the decision to move. On the other hand, it can kind of, you know, on the one hand, pushing people out. On the other hand, kind of keeping people in. And really, at the end of the day, I'm not so sure that the question of to what extent this is voluntary or not really matters for what needs to be done.
Absolutely.
What needs to be done is to make sure that people have the means to do whatever, you know, wherever they are, they have the means to have a life that is, you know, at least somewhat fulfilling, whether they end up moving or not. But the notion of to what extent they really wanted to do one or the other, first of all, is difficult to pinpoint down. And second of all, I'm not so sure that it's, from a moral perspective, I'm not so sure that you should differentiate between the two.
One question that I had is, you know, we talked a lot about sort of like the different incentives for why migrants would move. In your models or in your research, empirical research, I wonder what are the different factors that go into the migrants' decision making?
Yeah, so that's a pretty complicated question. I mean, I can tell you what I put in my model. In general, what tends to be the case, what seems to be the case is that migration decisions tend to be a result of a whole range of factors. You can have economic factors, you can have social factors, political, demographic, environmental, all of that is going to play out. You're going to have factors that are kind of macro level in terms of which border policies are in place, but you're also going to have very much like micro level factors in terms of, do I have a cousin who lived in that place or something like that? And all of that is going to play out in the migration decision.
Right.
So what tends to be the case when you do some modeling efforts is that you try to include as many of those conditions as you can in your modeling exercise. Again, I think that probably you don't want to fixate too much on what exactly is the reason behind the migration because there are so many, you know, factors that play into it. I think the causality question here might not be the most relevant one. I don't think we care so much about what exactly makes people move. And, you know, when you do survey exercises, you know, plenty of people do field research and you realize that sometimes you feel it's exactly the same circumstances, but some individuals, when interviewed, are going to say, I'm moving for economic reasons. Some other individuals are going to say, I'm moving to meet my family.
Right.
And you feel like it's the same situations where people label it differently.
Yeah.
And it's fine. But I think to the point that we shouldn't get hung, like, stuck too much on the question of what's the causality.
Great point. And I think it kind of circles back to your earlier comment quite nicely when we were talking about, you know, is there really a distinction between whether you're a refugee because of a conflict versus other reasons? The fact is you're moving and we want you to have the right ways to do this, basically, right? Yeah.
So then in that policy space,
why do you think, like, what are the main obstacles to sort of move past this distinction between you are being displaced because of a conflict, therefore you should have the legal status and we're going to help you versus another group of people who we just discussed?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's kind of disheartening. I think a lot of it comes down to all those policies tend to be made, again, pretty exclusively from the perspective of the destination countries.
Right.
Which has been confronted in the past years with an increase domestically of anti-migrant rhetoric and really, you know, kind of extreme right push against migration, against immigration in general, for various considerations that often have very little to do with the migration experience itself. And so what ends up being the case is that policy decisions, which have really important consequences for all kinds of populations, end up being made really from the perspective of like a specific location or a specific group of people and not necessarily from the perspective of the people who are most affected.
Right.
That's the nature of, you know, the state system that we live in. I don't have like a direct answer into like how to change this. But I think what's important, I mean, from an academic perspective, what I'm definitely trying to do and what I think other people are trying to do is to shed light on what those types of policy decisions, what the consequences are for populations, again, not just at destination, but also in origin and migrant communities themselves.
Right. Would you maybe expand a little bit about the different types of border policies that you have looked into and the different type of consequences, perhaps?
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the papers that I put out about a year ago looked at the effect of different types of border policies on populations' exposure and vulnerability to climate change. And in particular, we didn't look like at specific border policies for each country in detail, but the idea was to have some kind of stylized version of what happens if you close the borders more versus what happens if you open the borders more and migration changes as a result of that. Well, what we find is that basically migrants, when they're allowed to do so, about 2/3 of migrants coming from lower income areas tend to migrate kind of out of harm's way, tend to migrate into areas where they find themselves really less exposed and less vulnerable than where they came from. So meaning they tend to end up in areas where on average there are less impacts on climate change and they are better equipped to deal with it. That also has important consequences because one of the very important aspects of international migration dynamics is the remittances. So all those money amounts that migrants tend to send back to their home communities and those home communities then are able to receive kind of in a direct way resources that help them cope with whatever they're going through at origin location. So that's a really important mechanism of development here. What we find, on the other hand, is that when you start implementing pretty restrictive border policies, basically what you end up doing is that you keep people kind of stuck in areas where they find themselves more exposed and vulnerable than where they would otherwise have migrated if they had the opportunity to do so. So kind of with a pretty stark consequence of border policy on populations' ability to cope with climate change impacts. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think hadn't been discussed as mm-hmm. such. You know, people had been talking a lot about migration policies
right.
as a response to yeah. climate change, but not the other way around. What we were looking at really was what are the consequences of those policy responses on actual communities.
Right, right, right. Absolutely. Yeah. And it seems like through the mechanism of, you know, migration and remittance, you not only build up the climate resilience of the local community, you also decrease sort of the inequalities between these different regions. It just seems like a win-win solution that shouldn't be easily passed, right? But I suppose now we go back to the earlier conversation when you were talking about why the border policies are so hard to enact, partly because the focus is mainly on the destination countries, right? They have this power asymmetry that it's really difficult to enact something that would be more beneficial for the vulnerable communities. I'm curious that on the global scale, do you see a movement towards more, you know, establishing some sort of convention that goes beyond the country level sovereignty to really think about as a global community what we can do for these vulnerable communities?
Yes and no. I mean, the sense that we live in a world, a global system for centuries that yeah. is anarchic in the sense that there is no global government and mm-hmm. countries. Mm-hmm. Basically, there is no like over entity. Even yeah. the United Nations don't really have like, on most issues, they don't really have enforcing power mm. on countries. And we've seen it in Glasgow that just finished last week, the last global climate conference. Mm-hmm. Those are conferences where countries come together to try and talk and convince yeah. each other.
Yeah.
But really, there is no global entity that says, okay, now it's enough. You all need to do this and that. Mm-hmm. That's not mm-hmm. how the world system works.
Right.
This is the world we live in. So what can we do in this system? So the latest governance scheme that has been designed to deal with the migration aspect generally, mm-hmm. focusing on international migration specifically, is something that is called the Global Compact for Migration. Mm-hmm. It's a non-binding framework that was signed in late 2018 right. under the aegid of the United Nations.
Yeah.
Most countries have signed it. I think only mm-hmm. a couple haven't, and the mm-hmm. US is one of the two. And basically what this framework does, again, non-legally binding, is that it provides kind of a holistic framework for dealing with international migration, regardless of the reasons that make people move. And it's an interesting framework, but again, because there is nothing legally binding in it, to your point of, is there any like overarching institution that would force countries to reconsider those policies? Mm-hmm. No, mm-hmm. countries at this point have right. full sovereignty in terms of what migration policy they want to right. they want to push.
Right.
The exception being the European Union, which kind of decides a lot of its migration policy as a union. But
right. Yeah. Right, right. So for people who are not familiar with the terms, what exactly does non-binding mean?
So what you mean in terms of non-binding is that the international treaty doesn't lead immediately to the national law having to reflect the obligation, meaning it doesn't become law. Mm. It doesn't mean that in the national law of the country in question, mm-hmm. they won't be able to do whatever has been forbidden anymore.
Right.
It's
right.
just a statement or an aspiration or however you want to call it about we shouldn't do that. But right. it doesn't have a value of law. And what mm-hmm. it means is that if countries don't do X or Y,
mm-hmm.
well, there is no enforcement mechanism. They don't get punished by it.
Right.
That's
right.
mainly what we mean by non-binding.
But is that a pretty critical step that international communities usually have to go through as the first step in order to reach a point where it's actually binding and laws are being enforced?
Yes and no, in the sense that there are plenty of international issues that mm-hmm. just are not governed at all by any binding agreement because countries have not been able to agree to any right, binding right, scheme. Right. Mm-hmm. On climate change, the Paris Agreement on many aspects is not at all legally binding
right?
Because countries have not agreed to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see other issues, mm-hmm. for instance, in international trade, that issue, there is
right.
many like legally binding aspects.
Right.
But in plenty of international issues, there is mm-hmm. nothing binding about it just because that's the way the world system
right.
works.
So we shouldn't, our audience and I shouldn't lose hope just because it's not binding.
No, absolutely not.
Right. So it sounds like the global community is definitely moving towards, at least, you know, the awareness of that. We need to have a better way of dealing with the current situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think you were kind of raising an important point in one of our previous discussions, which was it kind of almost feels that migration in the context of climate change and more generally, there is an overall feeling in the general discussion and the general public that migration is something that needs to be managed, that is inherently mm-hmm. something that needs to be dealt with. And it's kind of, I don't think it has always been the case in the general public's rhetoric. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think if you look more broadly at the history of humanity, like humans have always migrated. Right. So there is nothing inherently problematic mm-hmm. in the notion of people moving from one place to another.
Right.
I think it's particularly recently that we have seen in the public debate this notion of migration being necessarily a crisis.
Right.
The fact that people move from one place to another is not inherently a crisis. That's not inherently a problem. The question is, to what extent they are constrained in either moving or not moving, and to mm-hmm. what extent they have access to the means that could help them have a comfortable life for themselves. Mm-hmm. So the question really, I mean, what I find kind of disheartening sometimes, you were mm-hmm. saying how you felt reassured about, you know, kind of the recent policy responses, that there seems to be an awareness that we need to deal with this issue. Well, yes and no, because I think what the awareness has been sometimes is that migration is a problem and people need to deal with it, where right. I don't think that's how it should be framed. Mm. And that doesn't not reflect the reality on the ground. The reality on the ground is to what extent people are constrained in their mobility decisions, whether the mobility goes one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from a policy perspective, you want to be really careful in not framing migration inherently as a problem. Because
mm-hmm.
yes, some people are displaced. And again, let's not minimize that. That's a tragedy. Yeah. And some people would very much, you know, are very much attached to where they grew up. And, you know, indigenous communities have very, you know, tight links and, you know, to the areas that are sacred to them. And that's very, very important. But let's not go from there to problematizing migration overall. Different people mean different things with mm-hmm. when they say managing migration.
Right.
If you want to make sure that migration happens safely, if you mm. want to make sure that origin communities are able to stay in touch, if you want to mm. make sure that destination communities are both find advantages in the migration yeah, yeah, yeah. and also are welcoming to the migrant communities, mm-hmm. all of that, if you think that all of that is management of mm-hmm. migration, I agree. And right, I think right, that's right. very important yeah. to do quite big portions of the policy discourse.
Mm.
When people talk about managing migration, by mm-hmm. and large, what they mean is that migration is a problem in itself mm. and we need to manage this issue.
I think that basically gets at the question of what is the end goal here, right? Then I wonder, you know, as a citizen, you know, of the world, what do you think as an individual you can do to help reach that end goal?
Yeah, that's a really tough question. I think what I'm going to say is true on migration, but it's true on climate change more generally. Mm-hmm. When people ask me what you think we should do, you know, a lot of the responses are societal responses and not necessarily individual responses.
Right.
So given that, what I tend to say when people ask me that question is that I see at the individual level, the two most important things you can do mm. are one, vote.
Yeah.
And two, discuss around you, mm-hmm. around yourself. Because a lot of those policy decisions, especially when it comes to topics that are so inflammatory as migration, mm. which seems to be inflammatory everywhere, and climate change, which seems to be inflammatory, at least in the US.
Right.
I feel like a lot of this, of the policy, you know, of the political capital that could help push a policy change
mm-hmm.
happens through changing norms, and that happens through conversations.
Right.
It might seem like very like anecdotal to, you know, you should talk about it to your neighbors. It's going to work out great. But I do see a lot of value in that. And I do do think that really at the individual level, one of the most important things you can do is engage with whoever seems to be interested, right, and especially right, right. whoever seems to not be interested right. at all in those issues, and talk about it. I really do believe a lot in that.
Right, right, right. I'm going to bring this podcast to my neighbor's dinner party next time.
Yes, please do.
As my activism for a healthy migrant situation. Well, it was a great pleasure. I learned so much today, and I cannot wait to read more about Elaine's work. Thank you so much for chatting.
Thank you so much
today.
For having me.
It's really
a pleasure.
Yeah. Fantastic. Thank you.
感谢你收听本期花间有剑客。
你可以在 Apple Podcast、Spotify、小宇宙以及其他泛用型播客客户端找到我们。
欢迎大家通过小宇宙评论区或者邮箱给我们留言哦。下次再见啦，
拜拜，
拜。